From Denver, Colorado, this is Democracy Now!
Yusur and Razan, these kids, their face was so radiant. They would just bring light to the room. And they treat me like their mother.
I see you nowadays, and you're always asking, how are you? You know, where are you now in life? And now I'm at NC State University.
And got married to one of my other students.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting.
I was so happy, you know, when I saw you guys together. And you will be together for the rest of your life, inshallah.
As over 5,000 people attend the funeral of the three Muslim students murdered in Chapel Hill, we'll hear one of the victims, Yusur Abu Salah, in her own words. Last year, she went into a StoryCorps booth to record an interview with her third grade teacher. Then to the case of Jessica Hernandez, a 17-year-old teen shot dead by Denver police last month.
It's five teenagers. There's no reason for you to open fire on any teenager, no matter what. I can understand if somebody got out the car and pulled out a gun on him or something, but there was no incident whatsoever. He got hit by a car. My cousin got shot dead.
We'll also go into a Denver church where a Mexican undocumented immigrant has sought sanctuary in an attempt to stay in the United States with his 9-year-old and 15-year-old daughters and wife. We speak to David Sirota as well on the plot against pensions. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands gathered in North Carolina Thursday for the funeral of three Muslim students shot dead by a gunman who'd posted anti-religious messages online. Razan Muhammad Abu Salah and her sister Yusur and Yusur's husband, Dia Barakat, were killed execution style in what family members call a hate crime. Suspected gunman Craig Stephen Hicks has been charged with three counts of first-degree murder. Hicks had frequently posted anti-religious comments on his Facebook page. Police say an early probe suggests the killings resulted from a parking dispute, a claim the victim's family and friends reject. The FBI is also investigating. A crowd of over 5,000 people packed a soccer field at North Carolina State for Thursday's service, paying tribute to the victims and demanding justice for their murders. In international news, eight Ukrainian soldiers have been killed and several dozen wounded in continued fighting in eastern Ukraine. The violence comes just after Ukraine and Russia agreed to a new ceasefire at a summit in Belarus. But the truce won't take effect till Sunday. New shelling has been reported today in the rebel strongholds of Luhansk and Donetsk. In Washington, State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said despite the ceasefire, the U.S. has not ruled out new sanctions on Russia or sending military aid to Ukraine.
An agreement is a piece of paper unless it's implemented. And so what we've seen to date is that Russia and Russian-backed separatists have not taken the steps to implement. We will see what they do from here. We have had long ongoing conversations with our European partners about additional steps that could be taken. And if it's not implemented or there's additional aggression, you know, that's something we will continue to discuss.
The European Union has also threatened new sanctions on Russia if the deal is broken. The United Nations has warned Yemen is on the brink of civil war and risks complete political collapse. Yemen has been in limbo since Houthi rebels forced the resignation of the Yemeni cabinet and then seized power. Addressing the Security Council, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Yemen faces a host of additional issues, including an al-Qaeda insurgency and a major humanitarian crisis.
Let me be clear. Yemen is collapsing before our eyes. We cannot stand by and watch. The country is facing multiple challenges. A dangerous political crisis continues in Sana'a. There are more widespread and lethal attacks by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, with increasing hostilities between AQAP and the Houthis in various provinces south of Sana'a, such as Damar and al-Bayda. There are increasing secessionist tendencies in the south and an acute humanitarian crisis.
The U.S., Britain, and France have closed their embassies in the capital, Sana'a, over security concerns. On Thursday, Al-Qaeda-linked fighters seized an army base in southern Yemen and held soldiers captive. At least 19 people have been killed and more than 60 wounded in an attack on a Shia mosque in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar. At least four suicide bombers wearing the uniforms of state forces reportedly hit the mosque during prayers. A federal judge has ordered the enforcement of her earlier decision striking down Alabama's ban on same-sex marriage. The ruling went into effect this week, but the state's Supreme Court Chief Justice Roy Moore sowed confusion after ordering judges and officials to ignore it. The ruling by U.S. District Court Judge Callie Grenade was directed to just one judge in Mobile County, but is seen as a signal to judiciaries across the state. Judges in just one-third of Alabama's 67 counties have issued marriage licenses to LGBT couples so far. With the new federal ruling, Mobile County resident Mark Stewart said he intends to marry his partner.
We go to church every Sunday. We work like regular folks, and we go and pay our taxes. We go home, watch TV like everybody else, and this is just our town, and we just want to be recognized in this town as being us. I've been with him 18 years, and he's going to be stuck with me now.
Kansas Republican Governor Sam Brownback has repealed a measure that protects state employees from workplace discrimination based on gender identity or sexual orientation. Governor Brownback's executive order undoes a move by his predecessor that widens safeguards for LGBT public employees. The Pentagon's approved hormone therapy treatment for the gender transition of U.S. Army whistleblower Chelsea Manning, previously known as Bradley. Manning announced she identified as a woman and planned to seek hormone replacement treatment after her 2013 conviction for passing cables to WikiLeaks. She sued the Pentagon last year for denying gender transition medical care and failing to follow other protocols for treating gender dysphoria. In a memo this month, a military official confirmed hormone therapy will be added to Chelsea Manning's treatment plan. The Senate has confirmed Ashton Carter as the new Secretary of Defense. President Obama tapped Carter after forcing the ouster of Chuck Hagel late last year. Carter has a long history at the Pentagon, where he once served as the chief arms buyer. In 2006, he backed a preemptive strike against North Korea if the country continued with a planned missile test. Carter has recently voiced support for arming Ukraine and opposing the transfer of prisoners from Guantanamo. The Senate approved his bid with an overwhelming 93-5 vote. Students at Harvard University are staging a sit-in to demand their school join the growing list of institutions divesting from fossil fuels. The campus-led divestment movement calls for purging investment portfolios of assets tied to companies that drive and profit from global warming. Harvard's endowment is the largest of any school in the world at $36.4 billion. The students launched their sit-in inside a building housing the offices of school administrators, including President Drew Fast. Hundreds of actions are expected around the world today and Saturday as part of Global Divestment Day. FBI Director James Comey has called on police nationwide to confront what he said is unconscious racial bias in the wake of a spate of killings of unarmed African Americans. In an unprecedented speech for an FBI chief, Comey said the nation's endemic racism must be addressed.
Much research points to the widespread existence of unconscious bias. Many people in our white majority culture have unconscious racial biases and react differently to a white face than a black face. Police officers on patrol in our nation's cities often work in environments where a hugely disproportionate percentage of street crime is committed by young men of color. Something happens to people of goodwill working in that environment. After years of police work, officers often can't help but be influenced by the cynicism they feel. A mental shortcut becomes almost irresistible and maybe even rational by some lights. We need to come to grips with the fact that this behavior complicates the relationship between the police and the communities they serve.
FBI Director Comey is known to keep a copy of the FBI's wiretap order targeting Dr. Martin Luther King as a reminder of the agency's past misdeeds. And the New York Times media columnist David Carr has died. Carr collapsed in the New York Times newsroom Thursday night and was pronounced dead shortly after. Hours before, he'd moderated a panel discussion at the New School on the documentary Citizen Four, along with its director, Laura Poitras, reporter Glenn Greenwald, and the film's lead subject, Edward Snowden, who was video streamed from Russia. Carr overcame a major addiction to crack cocaine in the late 80s and went on to become a celebrated writer on media and culture. He was 58 years old. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, from Denver Open Media. The FBI has opened an inquiry into this week's killings of three Muslim students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. In a statement, the agency said it had launched a, quote, parallel preliminary inquiry to determine whether or not any federal laws were violated. On Thursday, over 5,000 people gathered for the funerals of 23-year-old Dia Barakat, his wife, 21-year-old Yusor Muhammad Abu Saleh, and her sister, 19-year-old Razan Muhammad Abu Saleh. The suspected gunman, Craig Stephen Hicks, who described himself as a gun-toting atheist, has been charged with three counts of first-degree murder. Chapel Hill police say the shooting stemmed from a dispute over a parking space, but relatives of the victims say it was a hate crime. Yusor and Razan's father, Muhammad Abu Saleh, spoke at the funeral.
There's no doubt, as I thank Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for giving us this honor of raising three children. This has hate crime written all over it, and I'm not going to sit down and bend over that, because we need to know things the way they are. We have peace inside. We are not seeking any revenge. Our children are much more valuable than any revenge.
Muhammad Abu Saleh speaking at Thursday's funeral for his two daughters and son-in-law. Azhar Aziz of the Islamic Society of North America also spoke at the funeral.
We are concerned that the rising anti-Muslim rhetoric in our society may have encouraged some to commit violence against American Muslims. So we urge the law enforcement to investigate this case as a possible hate crime.
On Thursday's Democracy Now!, we spoke to Amira Atta about the murder of her childhood friend of Yusor Abu Saleh. Well, today we're going to hear Yusor in her own words. Last May, she did an interview with her third-grade teacher, Musarut Jabin, as part of the StoryCorps Oral History Project. All three of this week's victims attended Jabin's school. This week, StoryCorps produced a short piece based on that interview.
I'm Lina Anwar, one of the producers here at StoryCorps. Today, we'll hear the voice of one of the students killed in Tuesday's shooting in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
My name is Yusor Abu Saleh. I am 20 years old, and today I will be interviewing my former teacher and principal.
That teacher is Musarut Jabin, who taught Yusor Abu Saleh in third grade. In fact, she knew all of the victims, Yusor, her husband Dia Barakat, and her sister Razan, since they were kids. Jabin brought Yusor to StoryCorps last May. You're going to hear part of that conversation and a follow-up interview recorded just yesterday with Jabin.
She was the first one to come to my mind. She was one student I would like everybody to know about.
Growing up in America has been such a blessing, and although in some ways I do stand out, such as, you know, the hijab, the head covering, there are still so many ways that I feel so embedded in the fabric that is our culture, and here we're all one.
I remember Yusor as a little girl when she was in third grade. She had this sense of giving that really makes her different from other children.
I still remember in third grade, when we ask for something, you used to say, don't put your hand like this. You would have your hand facing downwards as if you're taking something from someone.
Oh, my God. You still remember?
And then you'd flip your hand over and you'd open your hand upward as, you know, a giving gesture. You know, be giving, open, compassionate.
Dia, Yusor, and Razan, these kids, their face was so radiant. They would just bring light to the room. and they treat me like their mother.
I see you nowadays, and you're always asking, how are you? You know, where are you now in life? And now I'm at NC State University.
And got married to one of my other students.
Yeah, that was pretty interesting.
I was so happy, you know, when I saw you guys together. And you will be together for the rest of your life, inshallah.
I just remember, Dia, when he was growing up, he was getting taller. And because I'm a short person, he would stand behind me and put his hand over my head. And I just told him, Dia, you can never outgrow my heart.
Before our time is up, Sister Jabeen, I'd just like to thank you. It's been an honor.
No, I want to thank you, Yusur. And the honor is mine. Thank you so much.
Of course.
I would like people to know and remember her as a practicing Muslim, as a daughter, and above all, as a good human being. You know, when we write our comments on report cards, we say they exceeded our expectations. She exceeded our expectations.
That's Musarut Jabeen, teacher and principal at Aliman School in Raleigh, North Carolina, where all three victims in Tuesday's shooting had been students. Yusur first came to StoryCorps in May with her teacher. This interview was recorded in partnership with WUNC and will be archived at the Library of Congress. Special thanks to Dave Isay and StoryCorps. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we turn to a police shooting in Denver, Colorado. The victim, a 17-year-old teenage girl. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're on the road in Denver, Colorado, broadcasting from Denver Open Media. We turn now to a police shooting of a teenage girl here in Denver that's drawn protests amidst a nationwide push for more police accountability. It was the morning of January 26th when Denver police shot and killed 17-year-old Jessica Hernandez. They say she and several teenage friends were driving a stolen car that struck and injured an officer. Police Chief Robert White says his officers repeatedly told her to get out of the car before they opened fire. But a passenger in the car who spoke with KUSA in Denver says Hernandez lost control of the car only after she was shot and became unconscious.
Cops walked up. They were on the side of her, and they shot the window, and they shot her. That's when she wrecked, and that's when the cop got hit.
Denver police do not use in-car dashboard cameras. We invited someone from the police department to join us on the show, but they declined, saying it would be inappropriate for them to comment while the case is under investigation. The shooting of Jessica Hernandez marks at least the fourth time in 7 months Denver police have fired at a moving vehicle, despite a policy urging officers to try to move out of the way instead of shooting. Two of those shootings resulted in the driver's deaths. In a statement, Hernandez's parents said, quote, "We are dismayed that the Denver Police Department has already defended the actions of the officers and blamed our daughter for her own death, even while admitting they had very little information. This unjustified shooting of our daughter is only the latest sign of an issue that requires federal oversight," they said. In an interview, Jessica Hernandez's mother also raised concerns about how her daughter was treated by police after they shot her. This is Laura Sonia Rosales Hernandez.
I was expecting the paramedics to take my daughter's body out with caution, but no, they slammed her body to the floor and dragged her like garbage.
Witnesses say Jessica Hernandez was dragged from the car, apparently unconscious. A video captured by a neighbor shows police handcuffed and appeared to search her after she was shot, rolling her on her back and stomach as she lay limp and motionless. The two officers involved in the shooting have been put on administrative leave while the incident is investigated. Last Thursday, activists angered by Jessica's death took over the stage at the National Conference on LGBT Equality that was held here in Denver, forcing Denver Mayor Michael Hancock to cancel his speech there. And on Saturday, an estimated 800 people gathered for the funeral of Jessica Hernandez, or Jessie, as she's known by her friends. For more, we're joined right now by two guests. Mimi Madrid Puga is with us, a community organizer and board member of the Colorado Anti-Violence Program, and Kusair Mohammadbai, civil rights lawyer, attorney for the family of Jessica Hernandez. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Kusair, let's begin with you. Explain what you understand has happened. What happened on that morning of January 26th?
We're cobbling together the facts still, but what we do know is that Jessica and four other teenagers between the ages of 15 and 17 were in a vehicle, and law enforcement descended on them on a report of suspicious activity. The vehicle was not moving at the time. And what we do know as well is that Jessica was killed by three or four bullets that were shot through the driver's side window with the car either stationary or barely moving forward. The witnesses that we have interviewed have all disputed the police version of the events that said that she was either driving at somebody or that there was even a officer that was struck at the scene.
Well, explain the scene. Like, what does—this was an alley where the car was?
Yeah, so the car was parked in an alley to the right side, and there were teenagers acting like teenagers. And police came from the front and the rear in vehicles. It's reported that they might have been unmarked.
What time was it?
It was 6:30 in the morning. It was reported that there might have been unmarked vehicles. And as Jessie reportedly put the car in reverse, almost at that exact moment, she was shot and killed three times from bullets, all traveling from left to right.
How do you know where these bullets came from?
The family, fortunately, the Denver coroner's office has reached out to the family, and they've informed us of some preliminary forensic and pathology results.
Did you do a second autopsy?
There was a second autopsy done.
So you're saying she was shot from the left side. She was the driver. So a police officer was standing right outside her door?
That's correct.
To the side of her?
That's correct.
And they shot her into her side?
That's correct. All bullets traveled. The bullet that was likely fatal was almost horizontal, pierced her left lung, went through her heart, through her left ventricle, exited her right atrium, went through her right lung, and ultimately was lodged near her ribs.
And what happened next, according to what you understand?
Well, the pathology and forensics will show that there was a fairly substantial abrasion to her nose, and the eyewitness reports say that there was a substantial, her body was mishandled. She was violently pulled out, and there was likely a blunt force trauma to her face as she was taken down to the ground and handcuffed.
She was shot, she was unconscious, and she was handcuffed?
She was shot, she was most likely killed. And then she was handcuffed rather violently.
I want to turn to an interview that the Denver police chief, Robert White, did with the Denver Post. He offered his version of how Jessie Hernandez was fatally shot by police.
Shortly after getting me arriving on the scene, and they received a call for a suspicious auto. The first officer arrived there, ran the tags, and it was a stolen car. Second officer arrived. The officers exit the car in an attempt several times to ask the individuals to come out of the car. Obviously, that didn't occur. And at some point, the original officer that responded to the scene, the vehicle started driving towards him, which pretty much had him between the car, and I think it was a brick wall and a fence there. And out of fear for his safety, he fired several shots, and the other officer also fired several shots, striking the driver of the car, which was a 17-year-old juvenile, and she was pronounced at the hospital. The officer, the original officer, received a fractured, by the way, a broken fracture, a fracture to his leg as a result of the incident.
That's Denver Police Chief Robert White. So he's saying there was an officer in front of the car and, I guess, an officer to the side, that the officer to the front of the car was shooting at her.
This is wishful thinking by the Denver Police Department. They've already changed and reformulated their public messaging here. First, they said that an officer's leg was broken at the scene. Then they've come out and said that the officer's leg was fractured, and now they're not even confirming that an officer was struck, only that an officer was injured. This is a largely cut-and-paste public narrative that the Denver police has had to do four times in the last 7 months to justify the killing of people, minorities, unarmed minorities in our community.
Mimi Madrid Puga, you're an organizer with the Colorado Anti-Violence Program. How did you get involved with this?
Mostly getting involved not only from community, but also understanding that Jesse could easily be one of the young people that we work with and could easily be myself and could easily be our community. We definitely feel that survivor support is crucial and necessary to any kind of organizing that we do in community. And we understand that Jesse's murder leaves many survivors, her family, her siblings. She was the eldest of five that we know. And she was also a pillar in her community, her own community of chosen family. In all these services and all these places, we've seen an influx of young, queer, lesbian, gay, bisexual, young people who come to pay their respects and their support. And so we know that we have to stand in solidarity between all these movements, between identities of race, identities of sexuality, identities of young people, too, because we see that young queer people of color are not valued in this institution. For example, the police. Our lives are not valued, and we understand that our lives are sacred. Our lives are worth keeping. And Jesse was brutally murdered. And as a community, we stand with her and with her family and ensuring that her story gets told in a real way, that she is not criminalized by the media, but that people tell the real story of who Jesse was as an older sister, as a friend, as a lover, and as a young person who had so much life left in her.
800 people came to the funeral?
Yes. Yes.
The funeral took place, Cusser, at her church?
Yeah, the church that her family and her had attended their whole lives, the church where she was baptized and where she was recently confirmed.
The priest very emotional in the service?
The priest at points breaking down and crying over the loss of Jesse.
Hmm. Mimi, have you spoken with Jesse's family?
Yes, we have. As our group at Branching Seeds of Resistance, a lot of us come from that Mexican family. A lot of us are first generation people who are born here. A lot of us share the same identities and some of the same experiences as Jesse. 10 years ago, I was going through the same rites of passage of being on the streets and being a young person and taking cars and being with my friends.
What do you mean, taking cars?
Either taking cars or being in situations that are
can be deemed as criminal, but are just rites of passages for a lot of young people. And that's one of the things that we've been talking about, is where is our culture, where is our art, and where are these institutions here protecting us to provide young people with opportunities and good rites of passages.
I wanted to turn to Jesse's cousin. After Jesse was killed, her cousin Jose Castaneda protested outside the district attorney's office and confronted Deputy District Attorney Doug Jackson.
I feel like there was a better solution to this. There's other tactics that they can use. There's other weapons that they could have used. It's five teenagers. There's no reason for you to open fire on any teenager, no matter what. I can understand if somebody got out the car and pulled out a gun on him or something, but there was no incident whatsoever. He got hit by a car. My cousin got shot dead. Nobody's gonna take that pain away. They can fix his leg. They can do whatever, but nobody's gonna bring her back.
That's Jose Castaneda protesting outside the district attorney's office. Can you comment on this, Mimi?
Absolutely. The young people in Denver and the young people across the nation are hurt, are in pain, and need healing. This is a traumatizing event for all the young people that Jesse shared her life with, her cousins, her family, even her school. These are the very same people that we're supposed to be trusting in and who is supposed to protect us. And when we see this happen, there's a level of pain and healing that needs to happen in community.
How does these protests that have been growing, I mean, 800 people at the funeral, they did not know Jesse, all of them, but came out in solidarity, fit into the Black Lives Matter movement?
Absolutely. I think that there's a sense of solidarity, and there's a saying that says an attack on community is an attack on me. And so I think that a lot of people were able to see Jesse's case, are able to see Jesse's family with that empathy that the priest talked about at her service. Empathy is what we need today. And so moving forward, solidarity is the number one thing on the spot. We need to have solidarity between race, between gender, between orientation, between ages, and have an intergenerational movement of healing.
Kusair Mohammed Bai, can you talk about the police shooting at a moving vehicle here in Denver, what the rules are?
The policies in Denver are largely antiquated. Places on the East Coast, more sophisticated organizations, completely forbid the shooting of at moving vehicles because it's common sense that shooting at a vehicle is not going to stop it from moving. Denver police has a largely cowboy Hollywood mentality where they think that shooting at a car will suddenly cause it to blow up and stop. It's not true. And so Denver's policies and their inability to correct them, despite four deaths in the last 7 months, has largely contributed to Jesse's death.
Again, how many times in the last few months?
Four deaths in the last 7 months.
What are you calling for now?
We're calling for the Denver District Attorney's Office to step aside voluntarily and allow an outside agency such as the FBI to investigate these officers criminally. We're asking the Denver Police Department to no longer investigate and police their own. These are broken systems, and it also just, it's common sense that brothers who are going to be investigating brothers, the outcome is predictable. And we know, based upon the Denver District Attorney's failure to prosecute any police officer for shooting since 1992, we know the result. We know that the Denver District Attorney is going to exonerate these police officers.
Finally, Mimi, the issue of Jesse's LGBT identity. The shooting comes at a time of increased violence against LGBT people. At least five transgender women of color have been murdered so far this year.
Absolutely. It's a pattern that we're seeing that, again, I said queer, transgendered folks see six times more violence than straight white people. And so this is definitely a pattern that's happening across the nation and across the globe. Queer folks are being attacked and murdered and killed, and our lives are not being valued as what they're for.
How do you think police perceive Jesse?
I'm not entirely sure, but Jesse was definitely masculine presenting. She had short hair. And I think that whether we are queer, whether we're passing as women or we're passing as men, it doesn't matter anymore. we're being shot regardless of what we look like, especially if we look like men, men of color. Even if we identify as women, we're being shot at the rate as men. And so we're asking people to text to get more information with the Presente.org petition, Justice for Jesse, and the number is 225568 to get more information and sign a petition.
The police have been put, Cusser, on administrative leave?
Yes, they have.
Is there a grand jury been impaneled?
Based on the history of the Denver District Attorney's Office, it is unlikely.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll certainly continue to follow this case. Cusser Mohammadbai, civil rights lawyer, attorney for the family of Jessica Hernandez, and Mimi Madrid Puga, a community organizer, board member of the Colorado Anti-Violence Program. We are broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, from Denver Open Media. When I flew into Denver yesterday, on Thursday, I went directly to the First Unitarian Society Church to meet Arturo Hernandez Garcia. He's an undocumented immigrant and father of two girls. Since October, he sought sanctuary at the church as he fights his deportation. I also met his 9-year-old daughter, Andrea, who is a U.S. citizen. Her status means he may be allowed to stay in the country under President Obama's new deferred action program starting in May, if he's not deported before then. Andrea was with her father when I went to interview him last night.
We've just arrived at the Unitarian Church in Denver, and we're coming to see Arturo Hernandez Garcia, who's taken refuge here. He's taken sanctuary here, the first one to do this in Denver since the 1980s.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman.
Good to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Can you tell me how you ended up living in this church?
Oh, it's hard. Because I have a long time here. I have 115 days already.
Why did you come here?
Because I'm in risk to deportation. October 21st, I have my final order for deportation. And the reason coming here is because I want to file my case.
Can you tell me what happened? How did you end up going into deportation proceedings? You had a tile business?
Yeah, I'm working on constructions, usually big constructions like apartments, 100, 200, 300 apartments, and 100 of the people working in there. And I am traveling with one person, and I have that discussion with him, and they call the police, and the police, they be arresting me. And after that, immigration put the whole immigration hold.
So what happened after that?
I'm in detention center for immigration for 15 days, and I pay a bail bond. I am a good person. I'm working hard here by 16 years in Colorado. I never been in trouble. I never be arrested. I never stay in jail before here in Mexico. And
you had your two children here in the United States?
I have one daughter that is 15 years old. She's born in Mexico, and she's in DACA, the deferred action for students. She's now get a permit job for her. Mm-hmm. And I have Andrea's 9 years old. It's a citizen.
So what has it been like for you? You've been here for many months now, for November, December, for 4 months.
Yeah, 3 months and a half already. It's hard for me and for my family too. I want to come back to my life, normal life, and come back to work and still in home with my daughters, my wife.
So we're here in the sanctuary with Arturo Hernandez Garcia. And his 9-year-old daughter, Andrea, has just joined us. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Do you come here after school?
Yes.
What grade are you in?
Fourth
grade. How do you feel about your father living in the church?
Sad. I want him to go back home with us.
What are you hoping for your father?
For him to go home and to give him a stay, for ICE to give him a stay.
for ICE to give him a stay. Did you also go to Washington, D.C. with your mother and your sister?
Yeah.
What did you do there?
We were at the...
the officer, ICE officers.
With the ICE officers and Homeland Security, and we were telling them that we wanted our dad to go home with us.
Do you think it will happen?
Yeah.
We're standing in the sanctuary, and behind you is a banner that says, "All souls are sacred and worthy. There is unity that makes us one." And we're standing in front of the organ.
We come here, United States, to work in the future for the families. We are not criminal. It's not true with the people, the government say, some TV. So I come in here to, just to work in the very future for my kids. And I contribute for the stay. We work and pay taxes. And that's all. Everything I do for my family. So
I want to thank you for taking this time to talk to us, Arturo, and your daughter, Andrea. We're here at the Unitarian Church in Denver, where Arturo Hernandez Garcia has taken sanctuary now for 3.5 months. I believe this is the first time someone's taken sanctuary in a church in Denver since the 1980s, during the sanctuary movement, people fleeing political persecution and violence in Latin America. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, and thank you for interesting in my case. I appreciate it.
Can you tell me your name?
My name is Beth Chronister, and I work here as the assistant minister at First Unitarian Society.
And what has it been like to give sanctuary to Arturo? First time sanctuary has been given in Denver since the 1980s.
It's really been an experience that has expanded the congregation. It has been an experience that has brought people together in a way to do justice. This congregation has a long history of being committed to justice, but I think in walking with Arturo and his family through this experience, it's been doing justice through companionship in a way that we have learned so much.
What was the decision you went through to do this?
So the process was actually about a 6-month-long process, and there wasn't instant agreement in the congregation, but it was a long process of dialogue, speaking from the pulpit, of doing small group work, and educating ourselves about immigration to figure out what was the way that we felt as a community that we could best affect the situation, which all ended in a big congregational vote, which was overwhelmingly positive.
How many?
Oh, my goodness. I think it was about a 90% yes.
And how many people in the congregation?
Oh, how many people in the congregation? We have a congregation of about 370.
Can't ICE just walk in and arrest him?
So the history with sanctuary and respecting sanctuary and churches is that they don't. It would just look so bad that they probably wouldn't. I think that there's the same sort of respect for schools and hospitals that they have for churches.
And how long do you think this will go on for?
Oh, my goodness. We are hoping that Arturo and Anna and his children are able to get to all be reunited as soon as possible, hopefully in this next week. But we've been hoping for this next week for quite some time. But we're in it as a community of commitment around him.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Beth Chronister. She is assistant minister at the First Unitarian Church here in Denver, Colorado, where Arturo Garcia Hernandez has taken sanctuary as he seeks to stay in the United States with his wife and his two daughters. I was with him last night here in Denver. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan for helping to film our interview. Well, we're joined right now by Jennifer Piper. She helped Arturo Hernandez Garcia enter sanctuary. She coordinates the Metro Denver Sanctuary Coalition as an interfaith organizer for American Friends Service Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now! Very quickly, explain the circumstances under which Arturo ended up at this church.
Yeah, the circumstances are actually really common and represent a lot of people in the community because of the strong link between police and sheriffs and immigration in our country. So he was laying tile at a job site.
He runs a tile laying company with his brother here in Denver.
Yeah, and they employ six people. And so they were, it was a huge job site, and they were laying tile, and a guy wanted to hang windows. And that gentleman didn't like that they refused him entry into the work area.
Because they didn't want him to walk on the tile that they just laid.
Yeah, it was not safe for him. It would ruin the tile. It would waste money and time. And they had it roped off. And the gentleman was white, and he started yelling racial slurs at Arturo and his crew. They said, well, you need to talk to the supervisor. If the supervisor says you can come in the area, we'll let you. The supervisor, of course, said he couldn't. He said he wasn't going to take orders from any Mexicans. He went right up into Arturo's face, and Arturo gently pushed him away because he thought he was going to hit Arturo. The guy went off and left, called the police, accused Arturo of threatening him. Everyone on the scene, including supervisors, general contractors, testified in court that Arturo did not instigate the argument and that he didn't threaten this guy in any way. And Arturo was found not guilty by a jury of 12 people. And despite that, immigration continued deportation proceedings against him. That was almost 5 years ago now. And so he has exhausted every legal avenue open to him in fighting his case and been denied discretion over and over again. So now things have changed a little bit in the legal arguments in his case because of the Deferred Action Program that President Obama announced in November.
Why would he become eligible under it?
So he has a U.S. citizen daughter. He's been here more than 10 years. Well, he's been here more than the 5 years that's required by the program. He has no criminal record. He's paid taxes. He meets all the requirements. The only issue is he has a deportation order that was issued last year, and that means that we'll have to ask the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to grant him discretion and allow him to qualify. But otherwise, he completely qualifies.
Quite something. This church has become a sanctuary church. For a new wave of sanctuary from the 80s.
Yeah.
Can you talk in this last minute that we have how this story of Arturo fits into the national picture and what's happening around immigration rights?
Yeah, well, we really see our immigrants organizing and finding ways to further resist a system that is widespread throughout our country. We spend $18 billion a year on immigration enforcement, which is more than all the other federal law enforcement agencies combined. And as long as we keep spending that amount of money on immigration enforcement, we'll see families like Arturo's being separated. We'll see people like Arturo being deported because we have this immense amount of resources that we're putting into deportation. And we have to ask, is that really the priority of our country? Because that's what the spending priority is right now. And as long as we see that and we see continued links between police and immigration, we'll continue to see key members of our communities deported. And so what we also see are allied communities who realize they know people who are undocumented, who are in deportation, stepping up to accompany and experience a little bit of the risk that people like Arturo are living every day.
And this sanctuary movement, is it growing?
The amount of churches who have committed to sanctuary is growing. The number of people actually taking sanctuary isn't. And some of that is because of this new program and some new opportunities for people to attempt to stay in the country legally. But even if they implement that fully, it will only cover 5 million of the 10 million or so people who are here.
Well, Jennifer Piper, we will continue to follow Arturo's case. And, you know, it's interesting, Jesse Hernandez and Arturo Hernandez-Garcia, they are not related.
No.
But their stories have intersected with their daughters.
Yeah, Arturo's oldest daughter, Mariana, actually went to school with Jesse, and his family has been very impacted by the violence of the Denver Police Department and the way that there's no accountability. And I think the lack of accountability with the Denver Police Department is the same lack of accountability we see in the immigration enforcement system.
Jennifer Piper is interfaith organizer for American Friends Service Committee here in Denver, coordinating the Metro Denver Sanctuary Coalition. She helped Arturo Hernandez Garcia enter sanctuary at the First Unitarian Church in Denver. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, journalist David Sirota. Stay with us.
En el sur hay un país que habla muchas lenguas. Ha venido del oeste a anidarse donde está. En el sur hay un país cargado de ideales, de esperanzas, de un sueño mejor. Un país de canto y color, un país de llanto y dolor, donde todos luchan unidos. Un país de esfuerzo y canción, de riqueza, historia y de voz, un país que es tuyo también.
Marta Gomez translated, in the South there is a country. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Denver, Colorado, from our friends here at Denver Open Media, Open Media Foundation. As we turn to a Wall Street scandal that's generated little attention but impacts millions of American public workers. In recent years, cities and states have been increasingly investing worker pensions in risky hedge funds, private equity, and other so-called alternative investments. Many of the investments are being done in secret, while politically connected Wall Street firms, including Blackstone, the Carlyle Group, and Elliott Management, earn millions in investment fees from taxpayers. Well, the Denver-based journalist David Sirota has been closely following this story for years. Last year, he revealed Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who once served as President Obama's chief of staff, received more than $600,000 in campaign contributions from executives at investment firms that manage Chicago pension funds. David Sirota also revealed the head of a New Jersey board that determines how the state invests its $80 billion pension fund was in direct contact with top political and campaign fundraising aides for New Jersey Governor Chris Christie during his reelection bid. Meanwhile, some states, including Illinois, Kentucky, and Rhode Island, have faced criticism for blocking the release of information about how their pension funds are being handled. Well, David Sirota joins me here in Denver, senior writer at the International Business Times. In 2013, he authored the report, The Plot Against Pensions, that was published by the Institute for America's Future. It's great to have you with us, David, for me to be in your town. Explain what this is all about.
Basically, states and cities are putting more and more of their pension funds in high-fee, high-risk Wall Street investments. And the question is that's been asked is now why. We're talking about a third of a $3 trillion public pension system being handed over effectively to Wall Street firms. High fee, that is the key point. Big fees. These firms earn huge fees off these pension funds. And the question is why? Well, there's two answers. One, public pension systems are trying to big bet their way out of their shortfalls. Politicians have not properly funded pension funds. They've not made their actuarially required payments each year. And so there are these shortfalls, effectively money that is owed to workers that hasn't been paid. And so rather than have a debate over raising taxes, a lot of politicians have said, let's give a lot of our money to high-risk Wall Street firms under the premise that that will big bet their way out of the pension funds, big bet their way out of the budget shortfalls. The problem is that the returns for the pension funds have been lower than the stock market, which costs basically nothing to invest in. So then the question is, well, why are you investing in high-fee investments that aren't generating better-than-the-market returns that we can get with no fees? And I think one thing you can look at is campaign contributions. You have Wall Street firms, executives at Wall Street firms, making campaign contributions, and one of the big goodies they can get back is pension investments, which kind of go under the radar. Nobody really, very few people really watch where these investments are going. The people who do watch are the Wall Street firms.
What does Governor Chris Christie have to do with this in New Jersey?
Well, his pension system is one of the biggest pension systems in the world, $80 billion. That is a huge, huge pot of money for Wall Street. And Chris Christie's officials have moved an enormous amount of money into hedge funds and private equity. New Jersey is now one of the biggest investors in hedge funds in the world. In New Jersey, what's happened is fees have tripled. New Jersey is now paying more than $400 million a year in fees just to manage its pension system. New Jersey has similarly delivered below median returns, that is, below median returns for similarly sized states. So it's paying a lot more in fees and getting less back than the typical pension fund, which, of course, is a double whammy for taxpayers.
When Governor Christie was asked about your, David Sirota's, ongoing investigation into the New Jersey pension system, he lashed out at Sirota.
The article that spurred all this conversation has been written by a guy who is a completely discredited journalist who's been fired for being inaccurate and inflammatory before. So, you know, right now, anybody who can, you know, pop up on a website calls themselves a journalist. David Sirota is not a journalist. He's a hack.
That is Governor Christie. You're a hack.
Yeah, I mean, this has been the answer from the Christie administration to simply lash out in a personal attack. But this is not a personal issue. This is about pensions for hundreds of thousands of workers.
And the head of the New Jersey board that determines the state's investments in the $80 billion pension fund?
He ended up resigning. His name is Bob Grady. He ended up resigning after there were questions about the proximity of campaign contributions going into the Republican Governors Association, Governor Christie, the New Jersey Republican Party, proximity to pension deals going out.
Blackstone Group, there's a major protest against Blackstone in New York that has to do with housing.
Yeah, well, in New Jersey, again, New Jersey moved $2 billion of pension money into Blackstone at the very same time that Blackstone waived a number of rules to allow Bob Grady, the head of the New Jersey pension system, to allow his firm to invest in Blackstone at the same time.
What do you think needs to happen?
Well, clearly there needs to be more transparency. As you mentioned in the beginning, if you're a retiree, if you're a taxpayer, and you call up your state and you say, I'd like to see the terms of the deals about these pension investments that my taxpayer dollars are going to, your state will likely say, I'm sorry, we can't tell you what the terms of the deals are, what the fee structures are, what the risk analysis is. So there needs to be more transparency, and there needs to be a debate, a healthy debate, over whether this money is being properly invested, whether this is a prudent investment in high-fee Wall Street firms.
Can you say something quickly about Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel?
Sure. I mean, in Chicago, he has said that the city doesn't have enough money to pay its pension obligations. Meanwhile, more of that money has moved into so-called alternative investments, paying higher fees. And let's remember, there is an SEC rule on the books that says you cannot accept campaign contributions if you're running a pension system from the people who are managing your pension system. And Chicago lawmakers have asked for an SEC investigation in Chicago about his campaign contributors.
Well, David Sirota, there's so much more to talk about, and we'll get you back on again. David Sirota, senior writer at the International Business Times, will link to his report, The Plot Against Pensions. And that does it for our broadcast. Very happy birthday to Brendan Allen. And I want to thank our crew here at Denver Open Media, the Open Media Foundation, Tony Shawcross, Anthes, John Aiden, Gavin Dahl, Ivy Farr, Susanna McLeod, Dana Thibault, Courtney Steele, Nikki Smith-Reynolds, and Davis Stewart. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan. I'll be speaking at the Carbondale Public Library tonight at 7 o'clock. Hope to see people there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Mike DiFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, Jessica Lee, David Prude, and Vesta Godars. Our website is democracynow.org. You can read transcripts here and watch our podcast there. I'm Amy Goodman from Denver, Colorado. Thanks so much for joining us.